Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, presents The Wisdom of Fools, a review by Sarah Nicol Moore in the summer 2025 issue of James Goldberg, Nicole Wilkes Goldberg, and Mattathias Singh's book, Tales of the Chelm First Ward. This automated voice rendering is provided in order to enable greater accessibility to our content.
Picking up Tales of the Chelm First Ward is rather like picking up a chunky, beaded necklace that you might find at an esoteric gift shop that smells of incense and sells various crystals, tarot decks, and innocuous souvenirs for your loved ones back home. You would be just as likely to find such a shop off the Royal Mile in Edinburgh, Scotland, as on a gravel road in McMinnville, Tennessee. The necklace has a nice heft. The beads are a bit eclectic and chaotic, but taken together, they form a delightfully cohesive piece of art. Tales of Chelm is a delightful collection of short stories centering on the follies of a small church congregation in Chelm, Poland. You, of course, already know that Chelm is infamous for the disproportionate number of fools that live there, due to an accident when the angel of God, who was assigned to evenly distribute fools around the world, tripped in Poland, leaving the town fool-flooded and witless. Each of the stories offers the kind of guileless wisdom you could only find in a place where the wisdom of the world is foolishness with Chelm, 1 Corinthians 3:19. Indeed, when visiting Chelm, you will almost certainly encounter Fruma Selig, a Relief Society president who loves to magnify her calling and who recently learned, much to her distress, that it is tragic to have a child marry outside the church. You may watch as Fruma carries this news to the ward council, where they earnestly discuss what exactly it means to marry outside the church. It may take several meetings and a well-intended but confusing church activity, but they will finally determine that marrying in the church means to marry someone who lives within the geographical boundaries of the Chelm First Ward. And although this discovery is a comfort to Fruma, who has one daughter soon to be married at the local city hall, she is also heartbroken for her other daughter, who will be tragically married in the distant Latter-day Saint temple in Freiburg, Germany. You may be tempted to correct Fruma to explain that a marriage that starts in a temple is exactly the kind of in-marriage encouraged by church leadership, but you pause and you listen, and you realize that perhaps the secret to a happy marriage lies more in the ongoing support of a community and less in a single location. And like Fruma, you begin to suspect that everything was somehow all right. Perhaps I misspoke earlier. Reading Tales of Chelm is less like choosing a beaded necklace and more like returning to your childhood school. You walk through the same double front doors. The main hallway still leads through the school. You walk into the classroom where you spent countless hours staring out through the window. The desks are even in the same place. The pencil sharpener still hangs from the wall, and the floors are still the same scuffed linoleum tile. But the posters are different, and the walls of the classroom seem shrunken, as if you don't quite fit properly in this room anymore. The tree outside the window is larger, while the desks inside seem smaller. When you visit the Chelm First Ward, everything seems to be in its proper place, but somehow different. Everyone in the congregation has a calling. The ward council is well-intentioned and ineffective. The primary children sing with gusto. Even the foyer has well-worn couches, scuffed walls, and regular attendance. And yet, the people of Chelm invite you to see the familiar in a new way. Zelda invites you to see the foyer as a place of quiet worship, where the small tier in the couch and orange crayon mark on the wall are evidence of community. Bishop Levy asks you how to assign callings to difficult members, despite knowing that God did not have a strong track record of stopping people just because there might be a disaster. You even find yourself reconsidering the adage of the wise man and the foolish man, when an object lesson reveals that structures built on a pile of hard rocks are more likely to fall down than those built on a bed of soft sand. You find yourself singing along with the Chelm First Ward Primary. The wise man built his house so it would stand. The wise man built it somewhere on the land. The wise man built a house like God had planned. And he didn't let the rains get him down. About three quarters of the way through Tales of Chelm, you start to get a little worried. These people are starting to make sense, you realize. You step away from the book for a bit to pick up something familiar, something grounding. Perhaps, like me, you reassure yourself with the cadences of Chaucer, peel an orange, and go for a walk. You then pick up the book back up and return to Chelm. You find yourself in bed with Shayna and her despondent husband. Since moving to Chelm, Stefan has become more and more disoriented as he tries to make sense of the town's chaos. Trying to comfort her husband, Shayna retells the old Jewish tale of the rabbi and the king. The kingdom's grain supply is tainted, she says, and will cause everyone to go mad. There is only enough good grain left for two people who could remain sane while everything around them spins into chaos. They choose together to reject sanity and eat the tainted grain along with the rest of the kingdom with the precaution that they mark their foreheads first, so that when they gaze upon each other, they will know that of all the people in the world, we at least will know that we are insane. You gaze at the book. The book gazes back and you sigh softly, accepting perhaps that you, like the rest of Chelm and perhaps the world, are insane.
Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, presents A Book of Mormon for the Ages, a review by Russell Arben Fox in the summer 2025 issue of Grant Hardy's The Annotated Book of Mormon. This automated voice rendering is provided in order to enable greater accessibility to our content.
For intellectually inclined, scripture studying Mormons of a particular age, the path of Book of Mormon scholarship has been fairly straightforward. In the second half of the 20th century, there was the work of Hugh Nibley, which defended the text's historical validity and prophetic value through Old World cultural comparisons. Then came the writings of John L. Sorensen, who again focused on its historical and cultural plausibility, this time by setting it against New World archaeology and geography. At the beginning of the 21st century, studies of the Book of Mormon made a theological turn, exemplified by the work of Terrell L. Givens, launching an approach to reading the text as a distinctly American scripture that engaged the same range of philosophical concerns found in the whole long history of biblical reflection. Thus, over my lifetime as a 56-year-old non-expert follower of religious debates, the historical, cultural, and the theological angles of Book of Mormon reflection have been well covered. What has been missing, though, was a literary approach to reading the text. Not that this has been entirely absent. Throughout the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, literary appropriations from and invocations of different parts of the Book of Mormon's narrative have been fairly common. But reading the Book of Mormon specifically as one would analyze any other narrative, looking to understand the writerly or editorial intentions behind it, and developing interpretations that work from within the presented text itself, that has had a very minor place in the history of Book of Mormon scholarship. Until Grant Hardy came along, that is. A scholar of world religions and religious texts at the University of North Carolina, Hardy has been working consistently for more than 20 years to bring forward his literary take on what used to be regularly called the keystone of Mormon belief. As a climax to these decades of work, he has published the Annotated Book of Mormon, the complete text of the Book of Mormon, in the format of the study Bibles and critical editions of great works of literature that pedants like myself have been absorbing all our lives. And speaking for myself, the book is marvelous. I might even say, if this doesn't date me too much, a marvelous work and a wonder. Using the 1920 edition of the Book of Mormon's text, which is in the public domain, Hardy has structured the text with paragraphs, quotation marks, poetic stanzas, indentations, and assorted headings, all to make the reading of its often convoluted narrative more comprehensible. By so doing, Hardy has made visible the literary parallels, editorial breaks, shifts in perspective, historically revealing inconsistencies, and more, which too often have eluded even the closest readers of the text. His extensive introductions to the major demarcations in the book, The Small Plates of Nephi, as the editorial creation of Nephi, The Large Plates of Nephi, as the editorial creation of Mormon, and the additional material added by Mormon's son Moroni, as well as to each individual Book of Mormon book, plus the lengthy general essays, appendices, glossaries, and indices found at the book's conclusion, are all very much worth reading, as they point out. and reflect upon genre interpretations, narrative connections, literary constructions, alternative reading approaches as literature, as fiction, as world scripture, etc., and much more. But most fundamentally, I think it is Hardy's hundreds upon hundreds of explanatory footnotes, all of which bring new illumination to verses that many of us know well, that matter most of all. Consider a few samples, going from more specific to more general. 1 Nephi 2:15, "My father dwelt in a tent," a narrative detail that appears three more times in 1 Nephi 9.1, 10.16, 16.6, always in the context of providing additional instruction regarding newly received revelation. It may be an allusion to the tent of meeting, King James Version, tent of the congregation, mentioned 34 times in Exodus. This name of the tabernacle emphasizes its role as a place of revelation, where the Israelites or the representatives met God. Alma 7:7-8. Despite the preeminent importance of the incarnation, Alma does not know whether the Redeemer will visit the Nephites in his mortal body, and he seems unaware of Nephi's prophecies of a precise timeline and details of a post-resurrection visitation in the New World. 1 Nephi 10.4, 12.1-12, 19.8-11, 2 Nephi 25.19, 26.1-9. Because 1-2 Nephi was dictated after 3 Nephi, which included an account of Christ's appearance among the Nephites. Some have taken this as evidence that at the time Joseph Smith dictated the Book of Alma, he was still working out the plot of the bomb. Alternatively, it may be that Alma had not yet read the small plates, which were intended for the Lamanites, Jerem 1.2. In either case, Alma later comes to understand that Christ will indeed come among the Nephites after his resurrection, Alma 16.20. Helaman 12, "The Nephite Lamanite declined from righteousness to wickedness in just 5 years, 11.24-38. prompts Mormon to conclude the original chapter 4 with a lengthy lament about human nature. This is the clearest exposition of the worldview of the Book of Mormon's primary narrator, whose pessimistic tone seems to be colored not just by his reading of historical records, but by his own experience living through the destruction, degradation, and iniquity that characterized the end of Nephite civilization. Mormon will interweave into his lament allusions to the ministries of Nephi II and Samuel the Lamanite, related on either side of this editorial insertion. These three, and many more like them, make clear a few of Hardy's central assumptions. First, he takes very seriously the relationship which the text of the Book of Mormon has to that of the Bible, both in terms of the influence the writings of the Hebrew prophets had upon what became the Nephites' religious tradition, primarily via the brass plates, but also through revelations recorded by Nephite prophets which reinterpreted and applied some of those prophetic teachings. Second, he approaches the Book of Mormon as one who believes rather straightforwardly in the official received accounts of its translation and production. That is, he really does believe there were Nephites, and so he is fascinated to better understand these people through the records of them we have, particularly the way those records teach us about the Book of Mormon's three primary editorial voices: Nephi, self-confident as a youth, later bookish, and insular, with familial regrets and personal realizations shaping how he presented his early history; Mormon, an ambitious editor, firm in his embrace of various Nephite patriots and prejudices, but always mournfully conscious of the tragedy which they enabled; and Moroni, a reluctant editor, thinking solely of a future he will not see, Christianizing an ancient Jaredite document to emphasize his father's belief that all of humanity will face the same ultimate divine judgment. Third, he approaches the Book of Mormon with a sense that its authors and compilers were, like him, thinking about what messages they had to share in a literary way. They were, that is, writers and transcribers and record keepers, deeply concerned with the preservation of the crucial truths which the words of prophets, and ultimately the words of Jesus Christ himself, contained. In the annotated Book of Mormon, the concern shown by Book of Mormon figures with preserving truth in the face of pluralism and dissent, in the midst of constant fears over lost records or misunderstood traditions, is an echo of the diligent, necessary work which Hardy has committed himself to here. As a reader and believer, however heterodox, who is looking at the final third of my life, this remarkable accomplishment seems to fit my spiritual mood marvelously well. Historiographic and theological polemics have become less engaging to me, whereas understanding better the stories I have inherited, which in turn show me people trying to hold on to, sometimes losing, but always striving to recover or preserve, their own stories of faith and hope have become more so. Thus, for me, Hardy's project is a wonderful further scholarly step. It makes possible a reading, an interpreting, and a critiquing of this keystone text that puts us, as it puts in my imagination, Hardy himself in the same position as the prophet Mormon in the old Arnold Freiberg painting, sitting alone, surrounded by records, as Hardy surrounds us with the footnotes and references, reading and making notes, trying to see a story which includes one's own story through to its conclusion. I've owned many copies of the Book of Mormon in my life, but I know this is one that I will stick with until the end.
Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, presents Devotional Approaches to the Academic Study of the Bible and Book of Mormon, a review by Colby Townsend in the summer 2025 issue of Charles Swift and Nicholas J. Fredericks, editors of They Shall Grow Together, The Bible in the Book of Mormon. This automated voice rendering is provided in order to enable greater accessibility to our content.
This collection of essays is the fourth volume in the Book of Mormon Academy series from the Religious Studies Center at Brigham Young University. Earlier volumes focused on Abinadi, Ether, and the Jaredite records, and Samuel the Lamanite. This volume brings together 15 essays of varying sizes and quality. These essays look at a variety of aspects that connect the biblical world to the Book of Mormon, or analyze how the Book of Mormon takes up biblical themes or ideas or quotes, alludes to or echoes direct text from identifiable sources within the King James Bible. The essays throughout the volume have a devotional setting in mind from beginning to end and are thus not going to be of interest to scholars working in broader fields of American religion unless they are studying how scholars within Mormonism approach issues relating to how the Book of Mormon engages with the Bible and related topics. Some of the essays demonstrate deep engagement with biblical studies and knowledge about the field, while others are only superficially aware of the scholarship. For the most part, though, this collection deals with questions relevant to an educated Mormon audience and tries to provide answers specifically to academically minded members of that reading audience. Some of the authors engage directly in apologetics, often in more responsible ways than has been done in the past in Mormon circles, but others fall into what I consider problematic apologetic spaces. An example of the latter is an essay that continues the apologetic attempt to explain the skins of blackness that the Lamanites receive as a curse after Laman and Lemuel are separated from Nephi and his group. These attempts to explain away the text and create an alternative explanation are problematic for many reasons, but in this attempt, Jian J. Martin creates out of whole cloth a scenario where Lamanites gave themselves tattoos. This deals more directly than much previous scholarship in academic Mormon circles with the fact that the Lamanites are described not as wearing dark clothing, which at least one previous essay has argued, but as having dark skin and often only wearing a short skin girdle about their loins, Enos 120, so not much clothing at all. The problem here, like this previous argument, is that the explanation shifts the one doing the action of the curse from God to the Lamanites, rather than God cursing the Lamanites with something that then continues through each generation, implying an inherited trait through bloodlines. The description in the Book of Mormon follows far more closely the rhetoric surrounding interracial marriage, what would later come to be called miscegenation. Although similarly problematic, at least previous iterations of this argument were grounded in the text. For her argument, Martin makes up an entire series of possibilities about how Lamanites came to give themselves tattoos and why Nephite authors never mention them. The main impetus for these kinds of apologetic arguments seems to be an attempt to remove the Book of Mormon from the racism inherent in most early American literature, and thereby distance the book from its historical context. It is unclear to me whether or not Martin is aware that portraying global indigenous communities' practices of tattooing in this light similarly racializes the practices that she describes, i.e., by connecting them to a curse. Criticizing this essay is also somewhat uncomfortable because it highlights another weakness of the volume. This is the only standalone essay in a book of 15 essays that is written by a woman. The only other woman in the volume wrote with a male co-author. There are some essays in this volume that I think will be of interest to scholars that study the reception history of the Bible in Mormon circles. Daniel L. Belknap's essay delves deeply into how some authors of the Hebrew Bible conceptualize execution and the implications execution, especially of being hung on a tree, had for understanding the individual status with deity. Belknap's writing is dense and welcome reading in the context of Latter-day Saint work on the Bible in the Book of Mormon. In another example, Nicholas J. Frederick examines how some of the texts attributed to Paul appear throughout the Book of Mormon in subtle ways, rather than through lengthy quotations. This is incredibly important work, since some recent scholarship on the study of Isaiah in the Book of Mormon has cast doubt on scholars' abilities to do exactly this kind of work, i.e. identifying more subtle uses of a range of biblical passages in the Book of Mormon. I think this volume will be one that BYU undergrads, grads, and alumni who have an interest in scholarly study, mixed with a heavy portion of devotional argumentation and evidence, will find interesting. There were times, though, in my reading experience where I had to wonder if the authors were mostly writing to each other, their colleagues, and the leadership in BYU's religious education department more than any other audience.
Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, presents Opening Hearts and Minds in Chapels, a review by Robert Reese in the summer 2025 issue of Kerry Spencer Prey and Jen Lee Smith, editors of I Spoke to You with Silence, Essays from Queer Mormons of Marginalized Genders. This automated voice rendering is provided in order to enable greater accessibility to our content.
Kerry Spencer Prey and Jen Lee Smith have given an invaluable gift to the Latter-day Saint community in gathering and editing this impressive collection of stories by and about LGBTQ+ Mormons. These stories open closets and unveil histories that, in turn, hopefully, will open not only hearts and minds, but also arms and chapels for a growing segment of our culture that too often has been marginalized and kept in the shadows or imprisoned by our ignorance. I finished reading the 39 stories in this collection on the same day the reading from the Come Follow Me lesson included Alma 4. Alma, witnessing the discrimination by members of the church against the poor, the hungry, the naked, the oppressed, and others from whom they have withheld comfort and fellowship, uses an unusual construction in noting that they have been led by one piece of iniquity to another, Alma 4:11. In seeing their unequal treatment, not in general, but rather in pieces, I believe Alma intends us to see such treatment in its multiple specific and concrete ways, and to see its contagion. We are told, seeing inequality, Alma began to be very sorrowful, Alma 4:15, which describes my feelings upon reading. Some of the stories in this collection, which are described aptly by Lisa Diamond in her foreword as powerful, absorbing, inspiring, and heartbreaking. In their introduction, Prey and Smith focus on the paucity of queer Mormon women's voices in the conversations and dialogues that have taken place over the past 70 years, a time in which this community has become increasingly visible and increasingly marginalized in Mormon culture. They note, among other realities, that traditionally, female queerness, just as female sexuality, has been neither as visible nor as seriously considered as male queerness and sexuality. This book is a bold, essential step toward correcting that inequity. Prey and Smith organize their stories into four categories: essays on identity, essays on relationships, essays on shame, suicide in the closet, and essays on the church. The stories and essays on identity include the complexity of queerness, with the added issues of race, Jen Smith's Immersive Theater, Race and Disability, Melissa Malcolm King's The Silence That Echoes, and Autism, Met Harrison's My Agender, Autistic Mormon Life. Other stories deal with the complexities of being trans in a strictly binary culture. In I Give You a Name and This Is My Blessing, Ashling Ash Rowan reports declaring as a 12-year-old, "I'm no good at being a girl, and I never will be. I don't get it. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm doing it wrong." Years later, accepting their real identity, they announce triumphantly, "I'm trans. I know it, and I know God knows it, and I cannot deny it." By way of contrast, in his story, Frank Pellet, a 44-year-old software developer employed by the church, boldly announces his recent revelation that he is a transgender woman wholly attracted to women, and my wife in particular. As a faithful, recommended holding couple, they plan to remain true to their marriage covenants and trust God for whatever happens in eternity. That kind of trust is common among the authors of these narratives. At odds with the church over their sexual desires and gender identities, many hope for human acceptance in this world and divine acceptance in the world to come. The section Essays on Relationships includes, as one would expect, a wide variety of relationships within the LGBTQ+ spectrum. One I found particularly moving is I Spoke to You in Silence by Anonymous. It recounts a decades-long close friendship between two women in love with one another, but reluctant to act openly to affirm or express that love. Both married and with children, and aware of the forbidden nature of their desires for intimacy and aware of its risks, consider leaving their husbands, but remain faithful to their marriages and committed to keeping their families together at the sacrifice of their love. As the narrator summarizes at the end,
"We had never, not even once, crossed the line, but we didn't need to touch to have bonded. That was the greatest lie of all. That this was only a sin if we touched. That this was only real if we touched. That this... it can't be gay if you never, ever touch. But I loved you. I loved you."
So much love spoken over so many years with so much silence. The story ends with these sad words, I don't know if you ever heard. Some of the stories are about finally finding queer love, often after an arduous, painful journey, and then celebrating it. In Ordinary Magnificent, co-editor Prey, once married to a gay man and now married to a woman, says, in speaking of queer relationships, our identities and relationships, as different as they seem, aren't defiant. We are as we were created, and this is meaningful. Our inability to convey the strange, mythic beauty of our human variety doesn't diminish it. In recounting a small, ordinary moment of shared, intimate tenderness, the kind that takes place in any ordinary loving relationship, she says, that is what it queer love means. In this life, in other lives, throughout history, which is all it has ever meant. In her introduction to Essays on Shame, Suicide, and the Closet, Kimberly Anderson cites research showing that nearly three-fourths, 73.4% of LGBTQ+ people raised in the church have been exposed to strong, damaging language. Claiming that she herself is an expert on shame, guilt, fear, the closet, and suicidality, Anderson reveals that the only thing that kept her from taking her own life was not knowing how to operate the hunting rifle owned by her adopted father. The stories in this section chronicle how extremely difficult it is, especially for young people, to continually hear from the pulpit or the congregation that anything other than straight and cisgender is a tragic, sinful character flaw. One that will keep them from joining with their family in celestial glory for the remainder of eternity. I do not know the statistics on suicide in Utah these days, but I do know that for years, it was ranked among the top 10 states in the nation in the percentage of its population who committed or attempted suicide. Although the fourth group of these stories falls into the category Essays on the Church, nearly all the stories in this collection could be classified as such. The narrators of these stories identify the reason why the church is so inhospitable to them. As Prey and Smith summarize so succinctly, on a doctrinal level, queerness represents an existential threat not only to the salvation of the individual, but to the celestial family. That threat is evident throughout this collection. Perhaps the most powerful story in the entire collection is Jacqueline Foster's God Sits in My Kitchen Sometimes. This brief story is about a teenage girl who fears God will reject her for being bisexual. Ostensibly in a dream, she writes that coming home from school one afternoon and finding God sitting in the kitchen of her childhood home, she finally gets the courage to reveal her secret to her heavenly father. She says that instead of rejecting her, God, whom she intimately calls Dad, swept me straight up in his arms, bundled me into his being that thrummed with protective love, and together they get in the car and drive away. She ends by saying, I came out to God, and God left the church with me, adding, I woke up crying. In such a short space, it isn't possible to do justice to so many stories, including so many that are well-crafted and at times beautifully literary. What I find affirming is that many of these writers, some exposed to decades of negative rejecting sentiments, homosexuality is a major cause for the decay of the family, I had been taught. That there was something dirty and shameful about being queer, these are the same ones who tell us queer marriage is somehow worse than attempted murder, have survived to find authentic love and even joy. That is no small thing. In the conclusion to their introduction, the editors speak of the silences that have been broken by these narratives, adding, this anthology is just the beginning of breaking that silence. Within this silence is a sea of other silences. Prey is also the editor of the Book of Queer Mormon Joy Signature Books 2024, an excellent collection of essays by queer Mormons across the LGBTQ+ spectrum, highlighting the joy and beauty they have found in life. Had I the power, I would require the stories in both of these books to be read by every priesthood, relief society, and youth leader in the church. While I understand how difficult it might be for such leaders to read these narratives, I believe that reading them would make them better leaders, better Latter-day Saints, and better Christians. It is a colossal failure of our hearts and minds, as well as our imaginations, that as a church we have refused to entertain the possibility that some of God's children, including those with whom we share pews, join in singing praises and offering prayers, and with whom we make weekly sacramental covenants, have real, genuine, romantic, and erotic feelings and desires for bonding, just as heterosexuals do, but with members of their own gender or both genders, or that they feel they have been born into bodies with which their true selves are at odds emotionally and spiritually as well as physically. In other words, we have refused to see such people as fully human as ourselves, as fully in need of expressing and celebrating romantic and conjugal love as we, their straight gender binary fellow members, do. Instead of comforting and weeping with them, instead of welcoming them into fellowship, we have tended to marginalize and exclude them and, judge them harshly when they feel unable or unwilling to accommodate to the stringent limitations we have placed on their desire for love. Read these stories. They will open your mind and touch your heart.
Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, presents Transcending Both Orthodoxy and Disbelief, a review by Sarah Nicol Moore in the summer 2025 issue of David G. Pace's American Trinity and Other Stories from the Mormon Corridor. This automated voice rendering is provided in order to enable greater accessibility to our content.
American Trinity and Other Stories from the Mormon Corridor is a collection of short stories that grapples with the inescapable loneliness of disillusionment while offering a glimmer of hope in a conviction that transcends both orthodoxy and disbelief. Immersed in the Mormon experience, Pace's writings do not shy away from the grief, fear, and disorientation that so often accompany a so-called loss of faith. In prose that sometimes rivals Hemingway for its brutality, Pace delivers characters that confront the impossibility of human existence in a world in which the first noble truth is the inevitability of suffering. Pace frames his stories by utilizing the mythos of the three Nephites, apostles of Christ, who, according to the Book of Mormon, chose to remain on earth, ministering unto its inhabitants, until the second coming. In so doing, they linger in the world for 2,000 years in a state of undeath, eating, walking, breathing, and yet completely separate from everyone surrounding them. Of all the people who have lived and died, they alone seem to have perfected the command to be in this world, but not of it. John 15:19. It is into this liminal space that Pace presses. The characters in Pace's stories ask us to sit with them in the discomfort of existence, in the isolation of faith, however it manifests, and the inability to move on. The collection opens with the story of Zeb, the youngest of the three Nephites, who has reached the point in which his ongoing ministering is no longer sustainable. He seeks for connection with the people surrounding him by craving the one human experience he cannot have, death. He finds himself at the theater again and again, participating in the vicarious life on stage, until its pre-digested suffering becomes sterile and too easily dismissible once he walks out the door. So he follows the only option left to him, and he seeks out the Nephite god to beg release. When the sleeping god does not respond to his pleas, he finally bids him and his faith goodbye. Not as I want him to be, but as he is. What follows is a collection of stories that recreate Zeb's journey. We encounter Jack, drowned in a river, whose unfound body remains in that same liminal space Zeb wandered for so many years. We find Zeb again in the awkward tension between the two strangers, Paul and Saul, religious doppelgangers of Mormon and Jewish faith, who find themselves sharing a hotel bed. Like Paul, we consider the second skins we variously cover ourselves with, the garment and the kippah, the circumcised foreskin shared by Mormons and Jews alike, and finally the thin skin of a plane that separates us from death as we fly, the flimsy coverings we use to hide from God, others, and ourselves. Pace demands that we acknowledge the cowardice of a faith that cannot offer healing through justice, for justice requires courage. Queerness and airplane travel reoccur in Flying Bishop as Danny's queer self-loathing clashes with his desire to be seen as good, truly good. Magic realism infuses the text more and more as the collection progresses. High in the Himalayas, a mangy, whining, clinging puppy becomes a metaphor for failure in Eli's life, failure in marriage, in faith, in himself. The metaphor lies so thick in the dog's dark fur that it is impossible to separate the creature itself from the weight of all it represents, and the eyes of the Buddha statue, watching Eli as he holds the pup, seem sentient, if indifferent, to their joint suffering. Later in Angels in Utah, we encounter tiny ministering angels, mysterious angels who monitor the progress of the redemption of the dead and the living, and in so doing turn Salt Lake City into a surveillance state. Finally, Dreamcatcher offers a talking sphinx, a reticent but sentient statue, and an owl who snatches the dreams of the city. American Trinity ends as it begins by weaving together reality and myth to enable us to see how even the most ordinary of moments is imbued with the heavy weight of something an unanswered question, the reach of eternity, and the absurdity of life. The unflinching honesty of these tales brings Pace and Zeb together in the belief that the real threat to our lives is not disbelief or secret wars, but rather the loss of a record, of a book, not the loss of ourselves, but of the literary self. Pace's stories here are a type of sacrificial offering to Zeb, a gift that gives voice to those whose lives have passed away as it were, unto us a dream.
Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought presents In Sacred Rebellion, Joseph White Musser. A review by Cyrus D. Simper in the summer 2025 issue of Christina Rossetti's Joseph White Musser, a Mormon Fundamentalist. This automated voice rendering is provided in order to enable greater accessibility to our content.
Christina Rossetti's Joseph White Musser, a Mormon Fundamentalist, provides a comprehensive and analytically rich examination of Musser's life and theology, delving into his influential role in one of the more schismatic periods of Mormon history. The author's critique of scholars' overemphasis on the institutional perspective and her argument for a more balanced approach that recognizes the pivotal role of individual players in Mormon thought add a fresh perspective to the field. Throughout her monograph, the reader is invited to explore what it means to be part of the broader restorationist revisionist movement that made up early 20th century Mormonism. This volume is a must-read for those seeking a deeper understanding of the complexities of early 20th century Mormonism, particularly its fundamentalist branches. Rossetti's work is thematically structured, offering a multifaceted analysis of Musser's life and doctrinal innovations. She begins with a biographical narrative, tracing Musser's formative years, his ascent within church leadership, and his eventual excommunication. This biographical foundation sets the stage for a nuanced examination of Musser's theological contributions and his persistent advocacy for what he viewed as the foundational principles of the Mormon faith. It contextualizes them within the broader socio-political milieu of his time, underscoring the significance of his life and work in the context of Mormon fundamentalism. Rossetti provides a comprehensive narrative of Musser's life, emphasizing his unwavering commitment to faith and eventual divergence in the face of institutional change. Born in 1872, Musser was raised in a devout Mormon family. Musser was one of 35 children, and polygamy was an intrinsic part of his religious identity. This upbringing profoundly influenced his spiritual development and theological perspectives. In 1892, Musser married Rose Wimmer, and 7 years later, the couple received the second anointing, a sacred ritual believed to bestow the highest spiritual blessings. Despite the spiritual bond they shared, Musser's increasing advocacy for polygamy, amid ongoing legislative and church opposition, strained their marriage. This personal struggle, along with his familial responsibilities, often intersected with his commitment to his faith, influencing his decisions and theological stances. Rossetti's detailed account of these personal and spiritual conflicts humanizes Musser and adds depth to his character. Musser remained a fervent advocate for celestial or plural marriage, viewing it as a divine commandment and a cornerstone of Mormon theology despite the Church's recurrent renunciations of polygamy. He believed that the 1890 Manifesto, commonly called the "To Whom It May Concern" statement, did not apply to him or other high-ranking church officials, as evidenced by their post-manifesto plural marriages. His steadfast support for the principle eventually led to his excommunication in 1921. This period was highly influential, as changing teachings on celestial marriage created a doctrinal divide between the church and its members, underscoring the enduring tensions between traditionalist and reformist factions. Much of the book is dedicated to Musser's role in the study group criminalized under President Grant and comprised of those disillusioned with broader church narratives. Selected individuals from that study group would later form the Council of Friends under the direction of Lauren Woolley. Rossetti's detailed analysis of Musser's defense of celestial marriage provides important insights into the theological and cultural underpinnings of the fundamentalist movement and its resistance to the government. Rossetti also explores the Church's push to end the practice both publicly and privately, writing that it was as much a matter of reputation and embarrassment as a matter of policy and obedience. Rossetti examines the doctrinal disputes and personal conflicts that emerged in the wake of Musser's leadership. The tensions between Musser and others, such as John White, Barlow, and Joseph Lyman Jessup, are presented with a nuanced understanding of the theological and socio-political factors at play. This section of the book provides valuable insights into the complexities of religious leadership and the challenge of maintaining unity within a dissident religious movement. Her examination includes a discussion of Musser's writings and sermons, which grew to articulate the significance of the second anointing in achieving spiritual exaltation and maintaining the integrity of the priesthood. Musser's economic views and advocacy for a united order form another focal point of the volume, as Rossetti explores his financial difficulties and critiques of the U.S. monetary system, which he believed were ultimately incompatible with the principles of the restored gospel. In the last chapter, she examines Musser's promotion of the United Order, a system of communal living and economic consecration, within his broader theological framework. Rossetti highlights Musser's writings on tithing and the formation of the United Effort Plan, emphasizing these foundational principles as vital to early fundamentalist theology. These principles, she argues, allowed participants to survive and navigate their treacherous economic environment. Throughout the book, Rossetti situates Musser within the broader historical and socio-political context of Mormonism, particularly during the turbulent period surrounding the Church's renunciation of polygamy. She meticulously examines the legislative pressures and internal conflicts that shaped Musser's beliefs and actions, offering a nuanced understanding of the complex environment in which he operated. The book relies on a diverse array of primary and secondary sources, including Musser's journals, letters, and contemporary accounts. Rossetti's adept navigation of the available materials allowed her to present a detailed portrayal of Musser's life and thoughts. Her inclusion of direct quotations and personal reflections from Musser enables readers to engage deeply with his experiences and theological perspectives. While Rossetti's work is thorough, expanded analysis of certain topics would be welcome. Further work could elaborate on President Heber J. Grant's centralization of second anointings and its impact on the stratification of authority within the church. Additionally, a deeper exploration of Musser's relationships with his contemporaries and the Council of Friends would provide a more holistic understanding of his motivations and connections with his eventual successors. Perhaps Weber's theory of routinization of charisma could enhance this analysis. Overall, Rossetti's book is essential for anyone interested in the history of Mormon fundamentalism. Her meticulous research and engaging narrative shed light on the complexities of Musser's life and his enduring influence on Mormon thought. Her analysis offers a critical lens through which to explore the intersections of theology, authority, and social change, making the book a pivotal text for ongoing discussions in the field by sociologists, theologians, and historians alike.
Note: the Dialogue Foundation provides the audio format of this article as a courtesy. There may be differences from the printed version. For citational and bibliographical purposes, as well as to find any footnotes, tables, or images that are not conducive to an audio format, please use the printed version or the PDFs provided online at www.dialoguejournal.com.